Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Welcome back to The Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Nancy Solomon, sitting in for Brian. In 2018, we find ourselves in an age of alternative facts, fake news, and social media echo chambers. Our adherence to political parties is becoming less about a set of public policies and more about a tribalistic identity. Yet at the same time, America is becoming more racially and ethnically diverse. So will those new voices change who belongs and who doesn't and how we talk about politics? Our guest today sees the potential for this new majority, but argues that its ability to change the course of history is being sidelined in post-truth America. Here to discuss her new book, The Marginalized Majority, Claiming Our Power in a Post-Truth America, is Brooklyn-based writer Anesha Chaudhary. I'm sorry.
It's okay. It's Roy Chaudhary.
Roy Chaudhary. I practiced it. Believe me, I did. But so your political writing has appeared in Rolling Stone, The Nation, Salon, Mother Jones, among others. And you're the co-founder of a social justice storytelling group, Speech Act. Mm-hmm. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start at the very beginning. Who is the marginalized majority?
Yeah, so the marginalized majority refers to classic marginalized populations, whether it's women, queer Americans, immigrants. And if you look at the demographics, we constitute a growing majority. And if you include progressive white Americans who are, you know, the marginalized Americans' allies, we have currently a powerful majority. And I think that's something that continually gets sidelined in the headlines that we're continually reading about there being just such a polarized America.
And why is this majority marginalized? I mean, what are some of the factors that drive that so much power continues to be concentrated in the 38% that is white men in this country?
Sure. I mean, we're talking about racism and misogyny that is just baked into America. And it's something that if you just look at statistics, I mean, I think most people know by now that if you're talking about women and their hourly rate for, you know, doing the same kind of work that a white man does, there's just a huge discrepancy. You're talking about black men having a much shorter lifespan. And in a wealthy nation such as ours, it's just absurd that we still have such discrepancies. So when I talk about marginalized people, I'm talking about the Americans who continue to live in America that is quite different than the America experienced by a lot of white men.
You start the book with a personal story about yourself and growing up and your interactions with your Uncle Bill.
Sure.
Tell us that one.
Yeah, so my mother is white American. You know, her family has been here for many generations. And my father is Indian. He came over to the U.S. when he was in his early 20s. So being from these two different backgrounds, I think I learned early on how to see and straddle two different Americas. And so my Uncle Bill, on my mom's side of the family, he was not a blood relative. He was married to my aunt, but he did not believe in what he called mixed marriage. So what that looked like is that from a very young age, when I spent time with them, he just did not acknowledge my existence. So it made for some awkward dinner table conversation, or lack thereof. And it was not something that I found particularly notable when I was younger. And as I got older, that's sort of when I began to look at that more closely. And, you know, as challenging as it may have been and problematic at the time, I feel fortunate to have experienced that, because I think every family, every person can probably relate to a relative or someone they are close to who, whether it's overt or more subtle, engages in some kind of racism or misogyny or whatever it may be. The fact is, it's just so embedded in our culture that it's really hard to escape.
And how did this experience then sort of inform your perspective? And you know, you sort of leap off from there into the argument that you make in your book. So Make that connection for me.
Sure. So I feel like what I have learned over time, you know, I was a journalist working for publications like Mother Jones and other progressive outlets, and I covered the Bush administration during the 8 years that that was going on. And I think I was trying to, when I was doing that kind of journalistic work, I tried to adopt a tone that might be conceived of as like very balanced or neutral, speaking to, say, my Uncle Bill. I didn't want to put my identity or how I experienced racism or misogyny in my life on the fore. I didn't want to include that in my journalism or in my journalistic perspective. And I think as I got older and had more time to reflect on my personal experiences, I realized that I was really doing a disservice both to myself as well as to my journalism by not bringing my full perspective to bear.
I think many journalists struggle with those kinds of issues. So let's talk about identity politics, because, you know, you engage with this idea a lot in the book of the positive side of identity politics, of people sort of coming together and it creating a sense of solidarity, but then the divisions, particularly on the left, that identity politics can give rise to. So where do you fall in that? Like, when you thought about it, in the end, how do we best deal with identity politics without falling down that trap of it becoming divisive?
Yeah. I mean, I certainly can't give all the answers to how we navigate that. But one thing that I really focus on in the book is pushing back against, I think, this knee-jerk reaction and response to the notion of identity politics and the notion that bringing our identities to bear when we talk about politics, when we talk about our daily lives and the impact that political policies are having on us, we really do ourselves a disservice when we do not include our identities. And I think it's really important to examine who is saying that identity politics is divisive. And a lot of times what you find is it's typically white men. And I think the underlying conceit there is that somehow our identities are something that we can remove as though they're like a sweater in a too warm room. Let's just put that on to the side for now to focus on something more important. But when you look at history, when you look at who's responsible for some of the most profound change, we're talking about civil rights movement, we're talking about women's rights movements. Identity is at the core of a lot of some of the most substantive substantive change. So I think just my goal is to encourage us to look at history and really notice how identity works for all Americans.
Another major theme in the book is cynicism, and how, you know, the idea that nothing will ever change is a self-fulfilling prophecy and really gets in the way of change. You talk about protest and some people seeing protest as being ineffectual. And I certainly have wondered that myself about protests. So where do you come down on that one? Mm-hmm. You know, to what degree? I mean, we've seen a lot of protests in the last year and a half. Sure. With the new president. How effective is that?
Yeah. This is another example of if we look at history a little more closely, we recognize how protest is profoundly effective. It's just a matter of there's a dissonance between how we look back on it versus how we experience it in contemporary times. So, you know, if you think about the people doing lunch counter sit-ins in North Carolina during the civil rights movement, you know, at the time, and freedom riders too, at the time, Americans were not supportive of those protests. Protest generally is thought of as not useful or disruptive, which it is. But then, of course, years later, we look back on that and we think, wow, that was remarkable. And of course that needed to happen in order to achieve a more egalitarian society. So I would encourage people to keep that in mind when we're looking at protest movements today, because there's just, a real knee-jerk reaction to, say, the Women's March, to, you know, in more recent past, Occupy Wall Street. And these are actions that, while they may not have achieved some immediate concrete goal, have mobilized thousands, have impacted the parameters of presidential debates, you know, in the case of Occupy Wall Street, have led to, you know, after Hurricane Sandy, Occupy Wall Street was responsible for mobilizing people to bring relief to folks affected by that hurricane in New York when federal aid was very slow to be provided.
I do a lot of reporting in New Jersey, and there has been a tremendous grassroots movement that has grown up since the Trump election. And when I talk to people, I often ask, almost always ask when I go to attend protests and interview activists, I ask them, so, you know, how did you become active? And it has been surprising how many, and this is a largely women-led movement, and they often say that they went to the March on Washington for women on Inauguration Day.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, there have been a few articles that are notable because often there's so many headlines about how, you know, this isn't necessarily achieving anything. But there are a number of women who attended those marches who had never really thought about running for political office, who then did and unseated some entrenched GOP leaders. So, you know, we're not always seeing it in the headlines, but these stories are happening. And I just hope we can all hold on to those in the midst of what can be a harrowing time where it seems like bad news comes out every day. There's also good news. It's just that it doesn't always make the headlines, and it's up to us to just hold on to that.
Listeners, do you see a difference between the stories we're told about democracy and your experience within it? We'd love to hear your thoughts. Give us a call at 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. We have to take a short break. I'm Nancy Solomon sitting in for Brian Lehrer today. We'll be back in a minute with my guest, Ainesha Roy Choudhury. By the end of the show, I promise I'll get it. And we'll take your calls. So stay with us. Welcome back. This is The Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Nancy Solomon sitting in for Brian. If you're just joining us, we're talking with writer and activist Ainesha Roy Choudhury. Oh, and her new book just out today, The Marginalized Majority, Claiming Our Power in a Post-Truth America. I'm just having a hard time with it today. Once it goes bad, it just continues. Let's stay on the theme of women and women activism. The Me Too moment or movement is something you talk about a lot in the book. You have personal experiences that you share. So let's start there.
Yeah, it was an interesting thing because this book, obviously, it's very timely. So I was working on it in a kind of frenzied, at a frenzied pace. And so as I was writing it, the Me Too movement was happening and I was, you know, including that in the book. And it was one of those instances in which my life was, you know, very much in parallel to what I was writing about. So a progressive outlet that I used to work for years ago, a few former female colleagues reached out. We started a conversation. It was just basically an email chain that was checking in and relating stories from the time that we worked for a man who ran that outlet, who engaged in a lot of behavior from, you know, mild sexual harassment to just general, you know, behavior that was unacceptable. And what came out in the course of that email chain and those conversations was the realization that a lot of us had really minimized the experiences that we had had at the time. And we, as that conversation continued, we were approached by being journalists ourselves in our community. People were, this was like an open secret that this man and his behavior, it was well known. A journalist reached out and there were a few stories about that. And then Hannah Jaffe Walt at This American Life produced a story called Five Women. And we basically came forward and shared our stories. And he resigned, which was something that, you know, again, like I had written about these things, but to experience firsthand the capacity for power and change that was possible when we came together was it was a visceral feeling, whereas before it felt kind of intellectual and academic. To have that happen really changed my sense of reality. And it was really difficult, too. I think even as we were sharing these stories and expressing outrage amongst each other, we had to continually remind ourselves, yes, this isn't reasonable behavior. Yes, it's the right thing to come forward publicly. Because I think we're all so used to minimizing behavior, whether it's, well, he's from a different generation. Well, he meant well. Well, he gave us a lot of opportunities when we were early on in our careers. All of these things are true. And yet, if we don't hold people accountable, we're not really going to see much of a change. And a big part of holding people accountable is creating spaces for community amongst ourselves, like I'm explaining between myself and these women, so that we have the strength to continue pushing forward together.
What do you think the relationship is? I mean, here we have a president who, you know, was caught on tape talking about harassing women, really, and assaulting women. And then he gets elected.
Mm-hmm.
That gives rise to Me Too.
Sure.
But what's that going to mean now going down the road? I mean, it's, you know, how is that going to create the kind of activism that's going to target the behavior of, say, the president and others?
Mm-hmm.
How does that turn into change?
Yeah, sure. I guess I would push back a little bit against the notion that we're going to change someone like Trump. I think that we're seeing remarkable change across the country in terms of like the number of men who either have been ousted because of their behavior or who have taken some time to really reflect on the role they've played in marginalizing women, in keeping women from advancing in their careers. So I think what's really interesting is that Time Magazine's quote-unquote person of the year recently was the women who came forward during Me Too, but the runner-up was Trump. So I think that perfectly captures the strange moment we're in where I like to think of it as the last gasp of, you know, some of these more, what I would say, extremist white men who believe that this behavior is their right. So I don't know that I think of targeting Trump and hoping Trump is going to change as where we should focus our energies. I think it's just about moving forward with the movement, an incredibly powerful movement that we've already begun in spite of this one person who is in office.
Let's take some of your calls. We have it's Bryant in Elizabeth, New Jersey.
Hello?
Hi, Bryant. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I appreciate it. It's just funny what you were talking about when it comes to the parallels between Trump and the Me Too movement, because I read articles about how we've been weaponizing, how they weaponized the free speech, and then how do you take that, like the arguments of free speech and the right between, and then how do you address that? Like, how do you attack those arguments? Or I'm not sure if I put it correctly.
Are you saying that how do we square the defense of saying misogynistic or racist things with freedom of speech?
Yes, yeah, because, I mean, at the end of the day, like, I always feel like we should have a certain tolerance without, I mean, and that's the argument, like, where does the tolerance end?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I was just at a protest recently, and a woman was handing out buttons that said, tolerance does not mean tolerating intolerance, which I think is a great way to think about it. I support free speech, very clearly. I think one thing I want to say is, that also means I support people if they say things that are hateful, misogynistic, or racist. They have to be prepared for the countervailing speech against that. And I also think there's no place for people in the highest office of power to be promoting racist and misogynistic rhetoric. So I think free speech is alive and well, as we're seeing, which is part of why I think we're experiencing the country right now is so polarized. But I think the reason that it feels so polarized is that we have a small contingent of extremists who are trying to set the terms of the debate. And I think what we need to do is recognize that the majority of Americans do not believe these things, and try to hold that in mind.
You told a nice story in the book that kind of gets a little bit at how to deal with speech and offensive speech when you're on the subway.
Sure.
Tell that story. That's a good one.
Yeah. So I was on a crowded subway car, and as every New Yorker has experienced before, there was someone who got into the car and, you know, just started preaching this really hateful rhetoric. And I had made the terrible mistake of forgetting my headphones that day, which is normally what I do, just turn on my music, drown it out. And when he kept going, and, you know, the New Yorkers did their job of telling him to shut up, move to another car, thank you, no thank you, but he still wouldn't leave. And so I told him that I would start singing if he didn't stop talking, because it was just a moment of realizing that I did not want to have to listen to that any further, and I didn't believe I had to. It was a train car packed full of other people who were not spewing racist rhetoric. So I started singing Row, Row, Row Your Boat, and I'm not a singer, so it didn't come out very well. But within a couple stops, pretty much everyone on the train was singing Row, Row, Row Your Boat with me. And that man tried to get louder, but, you know, the chorus of us was far too loud for him, and he just got off the train. My favorite part of that story is that we kept singing even after he got off the train, because it was just this joyful moment of realizing we could take the reins again. So I think ignoring certain people or drowning them out is absolutely appropriate, rather than letting them take over, letting them try to set the terms of the debate when they are actually the minority in that situation.
Let's try to squeeze in one more call. We're almost out of time. Henry in Ossining, New York. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. And although Brian's a hard act to follow, you're doing a great job today.
Thank you.
So my comment or question is really goes back to the discussion of identity politics and how it relates, in this case, to the Me Too movement. I think that we need to be careful as a society about when we talk about identity politics and kind of insinuate that it's either good or bad, because I think the notion of politics is all about educating and inspiring people to recognize what their common interest is, and in that sense, the people that circle around that common interest have an identity.
Sure.
I think the problem in today's politics, and it's identity politics, but it's wedge identity politics. It's Karl Rove, thank you, for figuring out issues that are so emotionally charged that they get large parts of the population to ignore their identity, to really vote against their, what is really, objectively speaking, their best interest, because they associate with something that they feel, whether it's a religious issue or a quasi-religious issue, or whether it's a racial issue, they feel that they have to defend it, and they kind of forget about their genuine interests.
Yeah.
We need to stop you there because we're almost out of time, if you'd like just a few seconds to reply.
Yeah, I agree. And I think what you're getting at is that the right is so fantastic at, again, setting the terms of the debate by appealing to certain quote unquote values. And I think if on the people who are identify as left or progressives, we need to recognize that identity is inherently political, and we need to have the courage to push back.
A good ending. Thank you.
Thank you.
We will leave it there with Anisha Roy Chaudhry. Out today is her new book called The Marginalized Majority. Tomorrow night at 7:30, she'll be joined by Jessica Valenti to read at Books Are Magic, which is at 225 Smith Street in Brooklyn. Anisha, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm Nancy Solomon, filling in for Brian Lehrer. Thank you, everybody.